Welcome to Radio Gorgeous. This is Donna Freed, and I am here with Barbara Borland, the author of I'll Eat When I'm Dead.
Hi, welcome. Donna. Thrilled to be here.
Introduce us to the story of I'll Eat When I'm Dead.
I'll Eat When I'm Dead is a murder mystery set at a fashion magazine. It is sort of half satire, half completely sincere. I think it's an incredibly fun read, and it came out in May of this year.
And you come from a magazine background, but this is your debut novel. And how did that transition? Because I will just say that I really enjoyed it. And it is a far-reaching book. As you say, you know, half satire and half in earnest. Far-reaching. It is a murder mystery, but it definitely had the feel of somebody who'd been bursting to say this for quite some time. So how did the book come about?
Well, so much of the book's plot, it's not even remotely close to a Romana Clef, I have to say. If that were true, I would have had the saddest life that ever was, I think. No, it began actually not necessarily as a result. I mean, they're related, but it began, I wrote the very first sketch of it 5 years ago. It was exactly 1 week before I got married. My husband was finishing, like the main character, his PhD in art history at the University of Chicago, and he had been it's a tough thing to try to go into academia and the humanities. And there's sort of check-in points along the way where you think, if I'm not the best, then I'm gonna quit and do something else. And this was kind of that last point. He was filing. He was on the market. The job market process for that is very long and involved. And so he was having his kind of final campus interviews, and we had no idea where we were going to live or how our lives were going to be. And he had this moment of, and we're about to get married, and he had this moment of total panic. And he asked me, what else could I possibly do with my life? And that's a really hard question, because he had spent 7 or 8 years effectively studying the semiotics of visual culture, and I'm not sure how many places that applies. And I had no answer, and I went to work the next day. And at the time, we were in Chicago for 1 year. He was working, he did a 1 year at the University of Chicago, and I was working at Harpo Studios on a couple of iPad apps that were related to the shows on the network. And so I had a cubicle with multiple screens and no window. And at lunch, I would go out and I would leave my screens, their electric buzz, and I would go outside and get some fresh air. And I was walking around the next day and I was thinking about, God, what could he do? You know, it was heavily on my mind. And I had this kind of joke thought, well, he could work at a magazine, but it would, of course, have to be a really progressive magazine. And in what ways can magazines still be progressive? And that is, I wrote this really weird, funny sketch, and that is where Rage, the magazine, the book came from. The way in which that they are progressive is about the labor politics that surround the garment industry, which no one does in media and or will ever do. That will never happen. It is a total fantasy.
Yes, I was going to say, that aspect was pure fabulous liberal fantasy.
It's total liberal fantasy,
and for
yeah.
people who haven't yeah. yet read the book, explain exactly what you're talking about.
The garment industry is a multi-trillion dollar global industry that employs tens and tens of millions of people worldwide, and it is not particularly well regulated. 98% of the garments that we consume in the United States, I'm sorry, I know this is in the UK, but I live in the US, so I'm going to say we, that we consume in the United States are imported. I'm not against importation. I have no problem with that. It's just that when you look at the prices of clothing, it's really hard to understand how anyone is making a living wage from that clothing, from most kind of mass market apparel, and they're not. And it's not just the ways in which people are paid to manufacture clothing or to assemble clothing. It's also the textile industry is the number two polluter of the world's potable waterways after agriculture, which is, that's a lot. That's a lot, you know, and you have 100,000 people die in China every year from water pollution. It affects the world in a really big way. And every time you open a women's magazine, there's always, every magazine, I think, maybe not Vogue, but every other women's magazine, you'll see a page that says how to budget-friendly looks for work or something like that. And there's always this kind of implication that by saving our own money, we're helping ourselves financially, that it's this kind of feminism to dress ourselves and to move forward.
Spend to save.
Spend to save. Yeah, exactly. And yet that is the antithesis of feminism, to delight yourself on the backs of the world's poorest women. It seems extremely upsetting to me. I think rage in the book was just, it was just my fantasy about what if someone had cared in the same way that, say, Helen Gurley Brown had cared about the sexual politics of the 1970s while she was at Cosmo. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a similar narrative to how that magazine was taken over by Gurley Brown, and yeah.
It also has the sort of bitter, not sweetness, but sort of the bitter but hopeful sort of letdown, disappointing letdown feeling of someone after meeting their hero. You know what I mean? Sort of like there's a sense in it that it's almost a love letter to what fashion could be or what its ideal was in your head at some point. And then you meet your actual hero and they're human and flawed and fallible and not as good as they could and should be.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's definitely true. Certainly when I was a young woman, I grew up overseas, and so women's magazines that were brought over by mostly, you know, friends' older sisters, and they held this really outsized importance, and they pictured adulthood in all these ways. And then you grow up and you go to work in media and you realize, you know, everything is kind of bought and sold. You're dealing with advertisers. It's culture is a business. There is not a... We like to think that culture is about choice, that we choose, that there's something to the word zeitgeist, that we care about the things we like because we collectively choose them because they're interesting. But that's not always true. The way that objects or trends find us is very, very deliberate. I wish that there was more deliberation about what that meant for working women, especially considering how hard women's magazines push feminism in this day and age. They are trying to sell it to us so hard. And I don't know if that's possible or accurate, given that most women's magazines are still full of these advertisements with kind of militarized makeup language, you know, combat-free radicals, that kind of thing. That you're an army of one against the burden of aging. Or that you have the visual language of advertisements, which I think is, frankly, incredibly repellent.
And it's intense and strong.
And it's intense and strong, and we are being marketed to. The personal care industry is going to be worth $400 billion next year around the world. Personal care, it's cosmetics, fragrance, shampoo, toothpaste, and maybe one more thing. It's a very big market. And we are being pushed to, quote unquote, better ourselves. But that is not bettering ourselves. That's not what better means.
But for Kat, your main protagonist.
Yes.
And for any other person working, living, you know, wandering through the world, not in a bubble, there are contradictions that we have to wade through and dualities that we have to house all the time.
Of course.
Yes, this is a huge industry, but I can't walk around naked. You know,
right.
One of my things is shelter, and that's part of covering my body and how we choose to do that. And also that how we have chosen to do that has always been an art form.
Yes, getting dressed is self-expression, absolutely.
And how we represent ourselves in every culture has been and remains important. And therefore naturally almost exploitative. You know, if it is an expression, there are do's and don'ts. If there is, you know, a great way, there's a not great way.
Of course.
And these are difficult things to house within us and to put within perspective.
Yeah.
Talk to me about, like, your journey, your personal journey with that. And you've talked about not wearing makeup and things like that. So
yeah.
talk to me about your...
I really go back and forth on it. I am... there's so many moments when getting dressed feels like a gift. It's so... I love to go to vintage stores. I love to kind of explore what it means to look like different kind versions of myself. And that can all be so fun. And yet, when it is tied to my self-esteem, so those days when you get up and nothing fits or nothing looks right, and you can't just get one thing right about your day, which is that you're going to decide how you look and go from there. And then it sort of tied to your self-esteem, and that can be really devastating. And certainly there's moments in life. We began this interview, I was talking about when I first started writing the book, which was the week before I got married. Getting married was crazy. I couldn't, being marketed to from the wedding industrial complex, and the number of conversations that I had with otherwise perfectly sane people where they would begin to just emit marketing speak. So what's your wellness plan? You know, that kind of thing. Like, I don't have, you mean my diet for my wedding day? I'm not doing that. You know, the idea that it was my day, the primping, the princessing, that this is meant to be relaxing. I find that so fascinating, that spa days are about, like, doing something good for yourself, and it's like, oh, have someone rip some hair out of your body. That's going to be so nice for you. It's a really tough balance to feel great about how you look, because the world is constantly, marketers and advertisers are constantly telling you to be dissatisfied. And obviously we don't live in a world in which women are in control. You know, we live in a world that struggles to validate even the wealthiest, most powerful women. They're cut down every day. They're assessed every day on their appearance, on how emotional they are, et cetera, et cetera. We all know the cliches. And I don't think we can pretend that anything different is happening. Women don't get to live their lives at face value. Our appearances still define us, even if we don't want them to. And so there's a practical balance of, I'd like to be taken seriously in a professional context. You know, I'm right now, we're at the offices of Quercus at Hachette in the UK, and I didn't roll up wearing last night's outfit. You know, I'm wearing clean, what I hope is relatively professional clothing. And so there's that kind of base practicality, but then there's also that you want to communicate what kind of person you are, and that you think you can do that through your clothing.
Mm. Yes. Not something that we're going to solve.
No, but those are the externalities that I think are at play. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And what was the... Okay, so you had sort of choices when writing the book. Obviously, you've done a lot of thinking about this. So how did you... Why the form that the book took?
Oh, as a murder mystery, you mean?
As a murder mystery and part satire and the, you know, that kind of voice.
You know, I think it's hard. Personally, I have not found a way to write about this topic without using a great deal of humor. And I think there's something in women's media, especially the way in which dead women are venerated as a product is fascinating to me. Vanity Fair, Graydon Carter is quitting now, right? But Vanity Fair has, I don't know, 10 issues out of 12. They've got a dead woman on the cover. Natalie Wood, Jackie O, Princess Di. It's amazing to me how much we process. Dead women are frozen in time. We sort of hold them up as these standards of beauty. I think that's such a wonderfully strange idea. And it is obviously it is so obvious in women's media that we're using dead women as a particular kind of commodity. And so if the book is about all of the ways in which we engage in commodities and commodify ourselves, the deaths in the book are just another part of that. Yeah.
Well, and also, and your heroine, Kat.
Yes.
She doesn't go, you don't spare her going through anything that the other women in the book go through. Body issues, talk about some of the other issues.
Are we using spoilers? Can we spoil?
Say for spoiler.
Okay. So, okay, this is spoiler alert. So she ends the book. I think the ending of the book is sad. She has an eating disorder and she moves it like full blown, really difficult, having a really difficult time with anorexia and goes to live with her parents, she quits her job and takes a new job at a 4-year-old company that's run by actual teenagers, which is not, these are not rational life decisions. And I think in the beginning she takes her life so seriously, and part of that is because having worked in media and met so many lovely women who work at magazines, women who work at magazines are not dumb. They take their lives seriously, and they take the sort of images of women's bodies seriously. And I wanted Kat to be that person. And it's not frivolous that she does that. It's a real thing. But I also I am not convinced, and the book is not convinced, that it's possible to commodify your physical being in that way without suffering. I don't think it's possible. Mm. I think there's too much baggage for what that means. And athleticism is a different kind of physical commodification. But for women to be a kind of model, to be an object that is only sort of a clothing hanger, is, I think it would be really hard to make a fulfilling life out of that, out of only that.
Which leads us nicely to, there is a sequel in the works to I'll Eat When I'm Dead called Maniacs.
Yes.
Is there anything you can tell us about that?
Oh,
and
gosh.
So far as you know so far.
Yeah. I've done...
More spoilers.
I've done a whole lot of palling around with it, I'll tell you that much. Again, commodification is the name of the game. Maniacs is about a software company that's run by teenagers, and it's defined in I'll Eat When I'm Dead as Snapchat meets Amazon Prime, and it's sort of my personal belief about where technology is going. Magazines are, and newspapers, and television, and websites all run on a very simple revenue model, and that is through ad-based revenue, right? So you have one side of content that's theoretically editorial, and then you have another half of the business that's soliciting advertisements and placing those advertisements in between forms of content. However you want to think of that, whether it's between news segments or, you know, it's something that's embedded on a web page. But that's not particularly efficient. And it's really losing money, especially for magazines, because for advertisers, why would that be appealing? There's no information about what's happening to your consumer. And with web, people can just turn those ads right off. I have an ad blocker, of course, on my browser, and there's things that I pay for. I pay for The Guardian, I pay for The New York Times, I pay for The New Yorker. I pay for Bloomberg Businessweek, which I weirdly love as a magazine, and The Economist, and everything else, if I get paywalled, then fine. That's fine by me. I just won't look at it. I'll just move on and get my news from somewhere else, because we live in this sort of infinitely repeatable cycle. Anyway.
However, one of the things that's coming out of what you're saying is that you are a happy and active consumer of news and content, et cetera,
yes.
Of media.
Yes, absolutely.
And we do want information.
We want process. Yeah. We want information. We want journalism. We want to be connected.
We want reliable information.
We want
things that we can trust.
Of course.
And brands and media that we can trust. And that has come to us in the past on the backs of people who were selling things to us.
Yes.
So now it happens.
Right. And sometimes those things can be compromised by how hard you're trying to sell things to people. You know, if you are Magazine A and your biggest ad buyer is, say, a multi-trillion-dollar global corporation that owns most personal care products... And you have for instance, and you have a story that's about water pollution in India caused by face cream or whatever, you're literally not going to run it. That reporting is going to have to find a new home, and that reporting is very expensive to produce. So I think there's a lot of stories that are being left out because ad revenue stops a lot of media organizations. I wouldn't say hard news organizations, but media organizations from doing what they need to do. Anyway, at some point, we're all going to be able to buy whatever we need to buy purely off of Instagram, because I think, or Snapchat, or whatever it is, whatever Facebook becomes in the future, or when Amazon is our global government and we just sell Alexa stuff. But effectively, and you can already see it. It happens in Instagram pretty easily. I don't know.
You look up something and then, wait a minute, it's on your Facebook feed.
Yeah.
You know, offering you a 30% discount.
And it's got a shop now button. We've got ads that are being loaded in. You can do kind of two clicks to get where you're going, but it's not going to be long, I don't think, before we're all implicated as advertisers. So once databases are capable of processing kind of that quantity of information, because I think it's more the quantity of data than it is the image recognition question, then anytime I put up a photo of myself, you're going to be able to look at it and say, oh, I like that top, and buy it. And I'm not selling it to you. I'm just being that person. But this is going to—I truly believe this. Maybe I sound like a total crank, but I truly believe that traditional ad revenue is dying, and what we're going to see is this— kind of referral marketing that is totally seamless. And in a way, it's sort of less compromised, because if everything is an advertisement, then nothing is an advertisement.
Yeah, yeah. So everything can be seen in the same light.
Yeah.
As opposed to thinking, because it is that unseen, it's when we don't have choice, and we think we have choice.
Yeah.
And it's those times when you are being really seamlessly manipulated.
Yeah.
And that you really don't have a choice. That where these drivers are happening, you know, and you think you're coming up with it on your own.
Yeah.
If you want to say, oh, I like what she's wearing, where can I get it? That's fine. Then that's something active in you. But when it's more insidious.
Yeah.
It's scarier.
And phones are this way. Phones are, A, they work off of kind of a variable reward system, you know, which is what casinos use. And because it would make sense, the way that data gets delivered, it would make sense to do it in batches, right? You don't need your Instagram likes as they appear. It would be far more efficient for the phone to select them in batches, compress them, and deliver 5 to you at a time. But it is far more rewarding for it to happen at any moment, and it keeps you checking. So there's that issue, and then there's also the question of choice. When we look at the phone, we think we're making choices, but we're not. What we're looking at is any computer program where someone has already defined a preset series of options for us, and we can choose between those options, and you're right, maybe that feels like choice, but it's not necessarily organically choice. And I really wonder how we're all moving forward with this, and so many people have been wondering this. I mean, I think about Super Sad True Love Story. I don't know if you remember that book. Gary Steingart, his first book was called The Russian Debutante's Handbook. He writes for The New Yorker. He's kind of a Sam Lipsidey, Queens comic satirical writer. He wrote this book called Super Sad True Love Story, which is based in a not-too-distant future. He wrote it 10 years ago, or it came out 10 years ago, so he wrote it before that. Everyone either has to... You can only work in media or politics. Those are your only jobs. And it's very much like the Black Mirror episode where they're rating each other on their the version of the phone. He calls it Apparat, and it's like an egg that everyone clutches all the time. And society sort of devolves in the novel. And Courtney Mom's Touch just came out, and that's about this question of the evolution of technology versus kind of human interaction, and what is organic and what is inorganic. And anyway, yeah. So Maniacs is about the commodification of objects and the commodification of youth. That's sort of broadly what I can tell you. And then plot-wise, stuff changes, so I'm not going to say anything.
Some of the same people, different stuff happens.
Yeah. The same cat's there, Bess is there, Sigrid is there.
Excellent. Is Mark Hutton there?
He makes some appearances,
may be there.
He's there. There's a new fella in the mix. For now, you know, he could get removed in the editorial process.
Never know. End up on the editing floor.
There was a character in All You and I'm Dead who just got turned into a phone. It was just easier. It was like, we don't really need this extra character here. We'll just make him into a phone.
Well, I think I'm probably answering my own question I think you have demonstrated the answer to my coming up question is, and you are also working on another book, Pine City, at the same time.
Thank you.
I was saying that answering my own question, that, you know, I think we can see that you're active, busy, thinking all the time, and therefore able to, you know, be working on many things at the same time. Tell me about working on different things in different worlds at the same time. And
there's some... Pine City actually takes place in a world without phones. There's no phones. It's at an abandoned hotel, kind of dirty dancing style resort that has been turned into a private retreat for a group of artists. And it's about a young woman. She's a painter. Her studio burns down. She has to remake a bunch of work, and she goes up there for the summer. And one of the founding members of this retreat has died, and she sort of really starts to get into what has happened. And it is a technology-free zone. And I don't... So much of that book, there's a lot of discussion of how do we commodify things that are beautiful, but for the most part, what's happening in this book, I cannot tell you where that came from. I just kind of violently barfed it out last year in a draft. As I was working on Maniacs, I just was working on this as well. And it's a weirdly sincere book, actually, especially compared to these two. And but they would like to put it out third, so that is where we are. But I'm very proud of it, and I'm working on it more later this winter. I'm actually going to a fine arts colony in upstate New York. They don't really take writers, but I sent them my chapters, and they said, great, we'd love to have you. So...
Pushed your way in.
I pushed my way in, yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Barbara. I can't wait to see what what produces next out of this.
Thank you so much, Donna. What a pleasure to speak with you and with Radio Gorgeous.